philosophy, so I finally decided I would check out religion. So I went to graduate school in religious studies. And so I was actually also interested, not in just an academic way, but also I was one of these people that was looking for the truth, which got me in trouble in the philosophy department. And so I sort of decided to see what thinking, well, I'll look at all the different religions in the world and I'll try to see maybe what they seem to have in common at their highest level or something like that. And by the time I met devotees, I had become convinced that at least Buddha was right when he said life is suffering. His life in this material world, I had no question about that. And he said that the cause of the suffering are our desires. I could see that. And he said, then you must become free from desires. Well, I gave a few stabs at it. It was really not very successful. But I thought at least, you know, this is really, you could see this pattern all over the place. So anyway, a friend told me about the Krishna temple, so I went to this place. It was, at that time, it was a little what they call a row house down by the University of Pennsylvania. And the crowd for the Sunday feast was students and hippie types. You could smell the marijuana and the patchouli coming off of their clothes as you walked in. And I sat down, and a devotee gave a chant at first, and a devotee gave a lecture, and he was a really stern character. And he started lecturing on the four regulative principles, and really in kind of a mood of chastisement. No intoxication, you know, that didn't go over big. No illicit sex, that was even worse. No meat eating. And at that time, nobody was a vegetarian. That was a pretty esoteric thing to do in those days. No meat eating, no gambling. So people all around me were becoming turned off. But that's when I became interested. I thought, wow, somebody's telling the truth. So it was just a practical issue of how do you really become free from desire? How do you control the senses? And he said that you cannot free your senses from material engagement unless you give a spiritual activity to your senses. And that was a brand new idea to me, even though by then it was my third year in graduate school and I had quite a few courses in Hinduism. That the idea of some spiritual engagement of the senses. And he recommended the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra for starts. And we had to engage the tongue and ear and chant the mantra. So I said, okay, I'll try it. Just see what would happen. I got a set of beads and went home and started to chant. And then my material desires began to go away. In fact, they began to go away so rapidly I got quite frightened. I didn't know who these people were. I didn't know what I was chanting, and I wasn't quite sure I wanted to become that quickly free from material desires. So I quit, and then I really felt awful, so I started again. And then I wanted to see, I wasn't really so impressed with the intellectual quality of the devotees I met. And I didn't expect very much, because the people that jump up and down the street corners and bang tambourines and things like that, you don't expect them to be very intellectually sophisticated people. You know? I was a snob, of course. But then the devotees at that time, they didn't have very many books. One had just come out, which was Srila Prabhupada's translation and commentary in the Isha Upanishad. And when I read that was really quite an effect on me, because first of all, I'd studied the Isha Upanishad a lot in several courses, and nobody knew what it meant. And here, the way Prabhupada did it, it became clear to me that he knew what it was. and that in his commentary to it outlined a really sophisticated theology. That was my area of study, actually, philosophy of religion and theology, and it was just incredible, and in a very simple language. So anyway, that one thing led to another, and here I am now. I stuck with it. Then to become a devotee in those days, you kind of had to move into a community, into a temple. So I did that, and the devotees told me I should, of course, quit my schoolwork. Useless waste of mental speculation and so on like that. They're quite disdainful of this kind of academics. So I sent word to Srila Prabhupada, what should I do? And he said, you should get your PhD. And nobody believed it. They were at a hard time. And someone told me, no, he wants you to quit. He's just telling you to finish because you're attached. But I didn't know. I took his word for it. So I kept on while a devotee, and ultimately wrote a doctorate dissertation and did all that kind of stuff in religious studies. I've been a full-time devotee, actually. The teaching I do is mostly with occasional lectures outside. I don't have an academic position. I've become a kind of religious bureaucrat for some reason, more than anything else. Anyway, that's a little bit about me. What about you? What, do you want to introduce yourselves? Because I know him.
My name is Kwan.
Are you in the same? What field are your PhDs in?
Information technology.
I guess that's the thing to take these days, isn't it? Yeah, sure.
Very glad to
This is the first time you've been here? Have you come before? No? How about yourself?
Gabriel. First year of PhD student at the University of Hawaii. Anthropology of education through the...
In the anthropology?
Of education.
Of?
Education.
Of education. Is that in the anthropology department or the education?
No, education foundation.
Okay.
Then, not many institutions have
No, I've never heard of it before. Sounds interesting, though. Are you doing work in both departments, anthropology and education, together? There's a guy who wrote a very interesting book about ISKCON, Charles Brooks, who was originally his doctoral dissertation at the University of Hawaii, called The High Krishnas in India. And it's been published, I forgot who published it now. It's quite a good job. It was in the anthropology department too. Yeah, University of Hawaii, Charles Brooks. It was, of course, some years ago. It was interesting to see somebody do a study of the Hare Krishnas in India from an anthropological perspective rather than just a religious studies perspective. It was a pretty good book. Yeah. And yourself? How did you end up coming here, so you know so?
Went to the study room today for statistics and for the line of
things. Okay. I see. This came along, huh? Okay. And yourself?
Crystal. Graduate student in Asian studies.
In?
Asian studies.
Asian studies, huh?
Yeah, the University of Hawaii.
So you've been here before. What do you do in the the regional studies department there? Just Asia? All Asia?
No, I concentrate on Asian studies.
You're in the Chinese area. Because so usually it's South Asian study or Southeast Asian study. Asia's big. Okay. And yourself?
My name is Vijayan. I'm international management. So it's much bigger than
Asia. Teaches how to run the world, huh?
Yeah, actually, Sachin and Juan also, we all have the same program, international management, but then we have our own specialization. Mm-hmm. So mine is management. Mm-hmm. And I stayed in Apple 2 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I was doing my MBA. Mm-hmm. I stayed here for 1 semester.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I thought I would just, didn't know exactly what to talk about, but maybe since this was supposed to be on Bhagavad Gita, I thought I'd talk about probably the most controversial thing about this particular Bhagavad Gita. As you can see, it's right on the cover. Bhagavad Gita, and then there's three words after it. As it is. And I know this puts the religious scholars, that it puts their teeth on edge, because everybody has the historical critical approach to things, and Prabhupada is really making this claim that what he's presenting and what he's giving is in fact the Bhagavad Gita as it is. Just the idea that there's a text that's stable and that means something is in a lot of places quite questioned, and then the idea that something that was spoken however many years ago in the past, of course the tradition says 5,000 years ago, but scholars use maybe 1,000 or 1,500, or you know, the dates vary. Anyway, from that time that you could bring it forward and have the text unchanged. The prophet says there must be no change when it's translated and represented. So how is this possible? One Indian scholar was so irritated by this, he wrote a book called Bhagavad Gita As It Was. he thinks there's a big difference. I want to talk about this a little bit. What I'll do is I've selected some things out from Prabhupada's here's from the preface. He begins an early part of the preface of his book. I don't have the page numbers here, but he says, if personally I have any credit in this matter, it is only that I have tried to present Bhagavad Gita as it is, without any adulteration. Before my presentation of Bhagavad Gita as it is, almost all the English editions of Bhagavad Gita were introduced to fulfill someone's personal ambition. But our attempt in presenting Bhagavad Gita as it is to present the mission of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. Our business is to present the will of Krishna, not that of any mundane speculator like the politician, philosopher, or scientist, for they have very little knowledge of Krishna despite all their other knowledge. So he goes on in this way. I'll skip a little ahead. Our only purpose is to present this Bhagavad Gita as it is, in order to guide the conditioned student to the same person, purpose for which Krishna descends to this planet once in a day of Brahma, or every 8,600,000,000 years. These are figures given in the chronology. And Prabhupada here doesn't shirk from stating these kinds of things. This purpose is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, and we have to accept it as it is. Otherwise, there is no point in trying to understand the Bhagavad Gita and its speaker, Lord Krishna. Lord Krishna first spoke Bhagavad Gita to the sun god some hundreds of millions of years ago. This is in the fourth chapter. Uh, 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 Lord Krishna says this to Arjuna. I first spoke this doctrine or teaching to Vivasvabha Sangha, who then instructed it to Manu, who instructed it to Ikshvaku. In this way it was handed down one after another to the saintly kings, and people understood it in this way. And so you can calculate how long it was, and that's what it comes out, hundreds of millions of years ago. Of course, Arjuna then asks Krishna, wait a minute, how can you have spoke to talk to Vivasvan? He's much older than you are. How is that possible? Then Krishna says, well, many, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember them, you cannot. So anyway, he makes this statement about on the sun, the Lord of the sun. In the Vedic tradition, the Kshatriyas, the kings, either descend from the sun or from the moon. They trace the descent back to the Lord, the God of the sun. They're called Surya Vamsha Kshatriyas, or to the moon, Chandra Vamsha Kshatriyas. So this is what he's talking about, this dynasty of kings which began on the moon. Krishna spoke this teaching, and then it was passed down through the. Well, you can look at this. Let's see, chapter 4 and beginning of chapter 4, just text number 1. Huh? The personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god, Vivasvan. Vivasvan instructed to Manu, the father of mankind, and Manu in turn instructed to Ikshvaku. There's a long commentary where Prabhupada gives all the numbers and the reasons for these numbers. And then the next text, too, a few pages on. This supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way, but in course of time the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost. And then the next text, that very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you because you are my devotee as well as my friend, and can therefore understand the transcendental mystery of this science. So here Prabhupada takes all this quite literally. He says, we have to accept this fact. Now I'm reading again from the beginning, the preface. And thus understand the historical significance of Bhagavad Gita without misinterpretation on the authority of Krishna. To interpret Bhagavad Gita without any reference to the will of Krishna is the greatest offense. In order to save oneself from this offense, one has to understand the Lord as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as he was directly understood by Arjuna, Lord Krishna's first disciple. So here's the other point. This is a dialogue. Krishna is speaking to Arjuna. And so Krishna is the speaker, and Arjuna is the exemplary hearer. He gives his reactions, what he, how he accepts what Krishna says, what he asks questions. And so this, he's the stand-in, how the Bhagavad Gita should be heard. He's a sort of stand-in for all of us as the hearer. So here are two points. One is this idea in text 2, evam parampara praptam. This Bhagavad Gita was received in this line of Rajarshis, kings who are saints. Raja means king, and Rishi means a saint. So these were saintly kings. And it was handed down parampara, which means one after another. And so this is the system of handing down teachings, is a tradition. for Parampara. And one of Prabhupada's reasons, he says that of his own qualification to present Bhagavad Gita as it is that he is coming in the historical line of the civic succession. Prabhupada is coming from what's called the Gaudiya Madhva Sampradaya. Sampradaya means community. And the succession, as I'm a disciple of Prabhupada, he was similarly a disciple of his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was a disciple of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, disciple of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Jagannath, and so on. It goes back, and it's traced back, ultimately, in this particular tradition, to Brahma, the Demiurge, the first created being who then created the rest of the universe, some primordial figure. And so the idea, and then of course Krishna appears again various times within that tradition and kind of renews things and clears it up when things get confused like that. So the idea about Parampara, it's essentially quite, there's a revelation. There is a direct experience of the divine. And in the Vaishnava traditions, there are different communities. We are called the Brahma Sampradaya because it traces this lineage back to Brahma. There's the Sri Sampradaya, the followers of Ramanuja, traced back to Sri Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune. Rudra Sampradaya, trace it back to Shiva. Like this, they all have this lineage. And so the idea is that there's some revelation of some exemplary person who has an encounter, who receives enlightenment from the Lord. And then the job of tradition is to pass it down without any change. Without any alteration. It's preservative and conservative in this way. And of course, can this happen? This is where everybody says, wait a minute, you know, we're in grade school, you know, we played this telephone game, you know, where everybody sat in a big circle and the teacher would whisper a sentence in somebody's ears and it would go around and then the last person would say the sentence and it got all distorted. So this idea of some lineage with the teachings going down, preserved just as they are, is a little difficult to believe. But that's what Prabhupada is saying. And what I want to do is discuss a way in which we can understand that this is possible, and what this really means. And so, Arjuna is another person that Krishna again appears on the battlefield of Kurukshetra and repeats this teaching to Arjuna. In this way, this was Prabhupada's attitude toward this. Now, with this idea of a parampara, one after another, Prabhupada says this, that knowledge that's conveyed through Shastra, that is to say, we call it scripture, must be received from a qualified person in disciplic succession. In other words, the idea is nobody makes anything up. Everybody repeats exactly as they've heard it from the predecessors and they preserve it. And this parampara, as I said, it has its origin in these very specific kind of foundational paradigmatic experiences of divine revelation. And what we call Shastra or scripture is the record of these experiences. Those original experiences also, after that, they are repeated by others, reenacted by others. Those are also recorded. And then also the understanding of revelation is also given there by certain great souls. That normative understanding is also conveyed in this tradition. Now, the real purpose of this parampara is not just to convey ideas contained in sentences handed down, but it's also to convey the unmediated apprehension of transcendence. And the idea of parampara is not just that you hear the teaching unchanged, but the original revelatory experience is recreated. It's reprised. In every generation, the experience is recreated without any loss or diminution, one after another. So it's not just the telephone game, or not just repeating things like a parrot on and on and on. So there has to be the right apprehension of propositional truth, but then the other thing, the unmediated apprehension of transcendence. And the purpose of understanding the first part, the propositional truth, is really to attain the understanding on the second level. There's a text that I've taken out. This is from the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the book that comes after the Bhagavad Gita, which says that when one practices the spiritual discipline of bhakti yoga, three things should happen, should develop simultaneously. Bhakti, that is to say, devotion, it should increase. Pareshanubhava, which means direct experience of God, or of transcendence. And virakti, which virakti anyatra, detachment from everything else. These three, it says, occur simultaneously in the same way that when one is eating, there is satisfaction, nourishment, and the eradication of hunger. You see, you don't have to ask. You eat, and then with every morsel, you feel satisfaction, your body is nourished, and your hunger disappears. So in the same way, by practicing properly, these three things are supposed to take place. Bhakti increases, like satisfaction. You're nourished. There's a direct perception of transcendence, and your hunger disappears. That is to say, you also become uninterested in anything else. This is the verse. So there's actually a method. The other thing that is contained in this parampara, or this idea of disciplic succession, is that within it is also a system of applied knowledge to effect the personal transformation of its members, so they gain the qualification to receive the experiences of transcendence that's contained in the tradition. So there's a spiritual discipline. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's an analysis, chapter what is it, 13? Three modes of nature. The Bhagavad Gita, yeah, 14. The Bhagavad Gita repeats what's very common to most Vedic philosophies, Hindu philosophies, and that's this notion of the three gunas, which Prabhupada translates as modes. Three modes of nature, three ways that nature acts. We see it everywhere. Things are being created, and when things are being created, the material nature is said to be acting in the material nature is being said to be acting in the mode of passion, Rajaguna. Things are maintained, then it's Sattvaguna, mode of goodness. Then things are destroyed. When things are destroyed or fall apart or decay, this is called Tamaguna, the mode of darkness or the mode of ignorance. So this is a natural cycle. Things come into being, they last for a while, then they fall apart, disintegrate, decay. The products of that disintegration are reassembled in another mode of passion. But in the Bhagavad Gita, these three modes of nature also are said to condition us psychologically. And so there's three types of people. You can divide people into three groups according to their conditioning by the modes of nature. And in this chapter, there's descriptions of these things. And the mode of goodness is better. But a human being who's in the... Well, let's talk about what we know very well. We know about the mode of passion. Because first of all, human beings as a whole are in the mode of passion. And the civilization that we live in now is a hypertrophy of the mode of passion, total overdevelopment of the mode of passion. The mode of passion is born of hankerings, longings, desires. A sexual desire is kind of the leading indicator of the mode of passion because it's creative, it's procreative. So that's the sex desire, but also economic development, busyness, all these things. This is the indication of the mode of passion, in which one is impelled by the desire to achieve the results of his works. In the mode of goodness, the characteristic is laziness, inertia, dullness, insanity. This is the psychological characteristics of the mode of ignorance. And the mode of goodness is based on one is calm, peaceful, and alert. That kind of consciousness in the mode of passion is very narrow and intense and directed toward the objects of desire. A consciousness in the mode of ignorance, you don't know what's happening and you don't care. You're just oblivious. A consciousness in the mode of goodness is alert and interested in what's going on, but detached. And so this peacefulness is there. And what Krishna says, the reason to know these is that for knowledge, by knowledge they mean spiritual knowledge, it depends on goodness. And the mode of passion, the knowledge is basically technological stuff, information technology, how to do things, things like that. But from the mode of goodness is actually, when the mode of goodness is there, one can begin to be in a position to have actual spiritual experiences. Because the idea is there that we ourselves are spiritual beings, And then along with us, the individual Jivatma, a spirit soul, there's also the Supreme Atma, the Supreme Soul, who's with us and is actually part of every experience we have is also an experience of transcendence. But because of the development of modes of passion and modes of ignorance, we don't see it. And therefore, to develop the mode of goodness, there's a spiritual discipline. That's why what I was interested in chanting, the effect is that material desires begin to go away. What would that do to the economy? The American consumer now sustains the world, right? What if they suddenly had lost their material desires? We are so far developed in the mode of passion, you see. So anyway, our culture right now does not support the existential conditions for spiritual experiences. But in this system of parampara, there's always a spiritual discipline of some kind or another, which changes the, when we say the existential condition, the way we explain it, in these terms, is that one would see as, am I making advancement or progress in this discipline? You would see lust, greed, anger, confusion, bewilderment would decrease, consciousness would become clearer and more calm, and you would begin to see things without the distortions caused by narrow, selfish interest, and gradually another way of experiencing the world. And then by following the other parts of the disciplines, you begin capable of actually having this spiritual experience. According to the Bhagavad Gita, the experience of transcendence, the experience of the divine, we are actually made for that experience. But we're putting our effort into another direction exclusively, and so it's been blocked out. So in a way, the interesting part about this kind of discipline is that Prabhupada called it a science. He used the terms science of self-realization because it's he says that knowledge means information that's contained in the Vedas, and he says it's a science because it is realized by the practitioner through his own experience. That's what he means by science. It's actually an English translation of the Sanskrit word vijnana. Jnana means knowledge. And vijnana means knowledge that you have directly experienced. You've not just read about it in a book, but you're a direct witness to this. And that's the purpose, really, is not just to give you some doctrinal truth or some theory, but to actually bring one to the position of understanding. And it's the interesting question is what Prabhupada really wanted to see was this actually to become recognized as a science. Right now, here is this is the Hare Krishna temple. Okay, what do we have here? We have religion, and our books are called scripture, and everything is based on faith. And there over at the University of Hawaii, you have knowledge. You have books of knowledge, and it's not based on faith, but it's science. I have two kinds of institutions like that. That's the general way things are classified in this way. But actually, of course, all processes of knowledge begin in faith. When you just sit down in a lecture hall and listen to a teacher you've never seen before, it is an act of faith. We place our faith all the time in someone. And so here also, one has to accept a teacher. Why do you embark upon some course of study? Well, you think you'll arrive at some fruitful conclusion, so you accept it in faith. You know, you sit down in your first year in college and you take a chemistry course, and some guy you've never seen before gets up and starts talking about things that in a philosophy department we used to call metaphysical entities, atoms, protons, neutrons, because not only has nobody experienced them, but they're in principle. So the really rigorous people call them metaphysical entities. But you know, you take it all down in your notebook and you believe it. What if you doubt everything from the beginning? You believe it because, you know, this is a university and this is their teacher and he's obviously got credentials. But say, you know, you're going to be a skeptic from the very beginning, and you say, how do you know this is true? How do you know there are these electron shells and covalent bonds? And then they'll say to you, well, we have experiments that show it, that prove it. Can I do those experiments? Yeah, because science is democratic. It's not some arcane knowledge, you know. It's open to everybody, and we show all this stuff. Can I do the experiment now? Oh no, because first of all, you have to understand the framework and understand the process of the science itself before you can do the experiment. I mean, you'll see little dots of light on a cathode ray tube, and you won't even know what those mean unless you understand the whole theoretical structure. So you have to learn it first, and besides, we don't let anybody near that equipment until the second year of graduate school. So basically, you've accepted the whole thing on faith. And if I say to you, you can have direct experience of God, somebody like Prabhupada, well, can I see God? Yes. Well, I say, what do I have to do? Show me God. Well, first of all, you have to be in a position to see God. And this is what you do. So give it 7 years and see what happens. So I think it's fair to call it a process of knowledge. It's not obviously the same as empirical process of knowledge. But nevertheless, this is what is available to it, and it comes down through this kind of a knowledge tradition, just like any science. Really, there's also a tradition. There are the previous people who have done the experiments and made the paradigms that we all follow and things like that. So I really don't think it's any different in principle. So that it cannot be called a science. Of course, it is embedded in a particular kind of tradition that people will call Hindu religion, as opposed to Christian religion, and so on. That's not the way I look at it, nor was it the way Prabhupada looked at it. It's a science of self-realization. We do not say that this is restricted to this particular tradition. I can, based on what I know from Krishna consciousness, I was just reading a text of Saint Bernard. And I can understand what he's talking about. Different tradition, lots of different things, but basically it seems to me there are certain laws of spiritual life and of cognition that also brought him to some kind of spiritual experience that was quite valid, and that it can be recognized. So this is difficult because maybe not that many people in the various religious traditions actually practice this anymore. or actually have such an interest in finding out. I think today, these days, we might actually have a possibility of a cooperative endeavor to actually get together and look at all these different varieties of spiritual experiences and begin to look at the various conditions under which they take place. At least in the Indian tradition, I mean, in the Vedas, already there's a great deal of plurality. It's recognized that people are on different levels, and that the absolute, single absolute truth may appear to people in different ways according to their method, their method of approach. And so there's a huge record of spiritual experiences, which is quite diverse. Yet there's a conviction that all this data can be ultimately unified. Anyway, so this tradition, then you have the people in the past who have these paradigmatic experiences. It's passed down through parampara. And then so this parampara, the tradition, is one after the other. It contains this system of applied knowledge, and so that the members can become qualified to receive those experiences of transcendence. So then the substance of this tradition of parampara is really the conveyed and unbroken flow of spiritual energy that purifies and sanctifies and illuminates its members. And so Prabhupada's point is that when Shastra, the texts that belong to this parampara, are expounded and transmitted within that context, does it maintain its original meaning and its purpose? Because the idea is that here, so many centuries ago, was Krishna Arjuna. They were together. If one really understands Bhagavad Gita as it is, one will also have the same direct apprehension of Krishna, revelation of Krishna, that Arjuna had. Let me just illustrate this with one. I want to look at, here's a, the book that comes after Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavad Gita's introduction to this one volume, Srimad Bhagavatam, which I guess the best way to describe it is the biography of God. Partial, as it would have. Is that too cold for you? Okay. And so in the Bhagavatam, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, he descends many times, repeatedly. And so this is the record of those many descents, of what happened, lots of the experiences of Krishna. And of course, the Bhagavatam, the bulk of it ends up being connected with Krishna's descent at the time when he spoke to Arjuna and his activities before and after. So in this text, the sages have gathered, according to the text, at the beginning of Kali Yuga, at a place called Kukshetra. And they asked a sage named Suta Goswami to repeat to them what he had heard previously when this text, the Bhagavatam, was first recited by Sukadeva Goswami, when the emperor of the world, Prakshit, was fasting to death. Shukadeva Goswami recited this text, and Suta Goswami heard it. And now, all these other sages want him to again speak just what he had heard from Shukadeva Goswami. So the translation of the text is that Sukadeva Goswami says, O learned Brahmanas, when Sukadeva Goswami recited Bhagavata there, that is in the presence of the emperor Parikshit, I heard him with rapt attention, and thus by his mercy I learned the Bhagavatam from that great and powerful sage. Now I shall try to make you hear the very same thing as I learned it from him and as I have realized it. So Prabhupada has a commentary on this. It begins like this. One can certainly see directly the presence of Lord Sri Krishna in the pages of Bhagavatam if one has heard it from a self-realized great soul like Shukadeva Goswami. So you see what his idea of what it is to actually understand this text. It's not just to read words, but to see the presence of the divine directly in the pages. That's what he wants to say happened. Now, you have to hear it from the right person, not from somebody who may recite the Bhagavatam as they do in India just as a profession to earn their livelihood, and otherwise they lead material lives, don't follow the discipline properly. Or you cannot learn it from somebody who just interprets the text by material scholarship. He says, one has to learn Bhagavatam from the representative of Shukadeva Goswami and no one else if one at all wants to see Lord Sri Krishna in the pages. Again, he mentions that this is the process, he says, and there's no alternative. And then he goes on to say how Sutta heard it from Shukadeva Goswami. And Shukadeva Goswami, in turn, heard it from Vyasadeva, again mentioning this specific succession. So Sutta Goswami is presenting Bhagavatam as he had heard it from Shukadeva Goswami. Simple hearing is not all. One must realize the text with proper attention. Here's the other part of it. Now you have to hear from the right person. But here's this notion of realizing the text with proper attention. The word nivishta in the text meant that Sutta Goswami drank the juice of Bhagavatam through his ears. That is the real process of receiving Bhagavatam. One should hear with rapt attention from the real person, and then he can at once realize the presence of Krishna in every page. The secret of knowing Bhagavatam is mentioned here. No one can give rapt attention who is not pure in mind. Now here's the other thing I was talking about, the right conditions for hearing, the mode of goodness, and higher than that too. No one can give rapt attention who is not pure in mind. No one can be pure in mind who is not pure in action. No one can be pure in action who is not pure in eating, sleeping, fearing, and mating. That is to say, the basic animal activities of life. Even those have to be done in a pure way. But somehow or other, if someone hears with rapt attention from the right person at the very beginning, one can assuredly see Lord Sri Krishna in person in the pages of Bhagavatam. So there is basically the idea that when one may read the text every day, but gradually it should come that the text becomes transparent. It no longer is a mediation, and it becomes itself a direct revelation. So this is a kind of a mysticism, you might say, where it brings about this kind of direct experience of transcendence. So this is really what Prabhupada is getting at when he says Bhagavad Gita as it is. That it's not just to be judged as a group of words, or simply as a text. It has to be seen in the whole context and in this spiritual discipline, and it's meant to bring about actual direct knowledge of the Supreme. When Prabhupada speaks the way he does, you may remind us of a fundamentalism of some kind or another, where you take the text as it is in a very unsophisticated and simple-minded way. But the context is of preserving the text is to actually bring one about to this perception of transcendent truth, which is actually real truth. I mean, this is the way things ultimately are. That is veiled. Right now, we are considered to be in the veil of Maya, and so what we perceive is not really the way we perceive the world now in our ordinary consciousness is systematically misleading. And so one has to come to the point of seeing things as they really are in this way, and then one can apply that in the world also. Anyway, Prabhupada was serious about this. Early on, he was invited to go to MIT and talk to a bunch of professors and graduate students. And he asked them, "Why don't you have a department of the soul?" And they were like, "What is this guy talking about?" But from his point of view, the department of the soul is a legitimate area for research. The methods will be different. And ultimately, one may be trying to get at the truth through an empirical means, but one comes this way, and then there'll be a very interesting job of seeing ultimately how, because the idea is that the universe, the reality is a coherent whole, how these things actually fit together. That's the task to find them out. Prabhupada certainly wasn't against material knowledge. Its misuse or its inflated claims to truth. That was the difficulty. And the fact that when we examine things through our senses, we are only able to see a part of reality. And usually the mistake that people make is, I've discovered this everywhere, the mistakes that intellectuals make is not so much that what they perceive is wrong. They found something real. They found something true about reality. You know, like take Karl Marx. I mean, when people start to look at political systems and cultural systems, and you start to look about what's the money, what's the finances, what's the power structure, who profits? You know, it lit up everything. You never noticed before. And it's true. I mean, it really did light up a lot of stuff that people never noticed and made a lot of things unintelligible, made things intelligible that formerly you didn't understand. But the difficulty is when what that discovery is taken as the key to all and everything. And then it becomes a problem. So this is usually the mistake that people have. So one thing that's left out in modern life is this dimension here that Prabhupada is trying to reintroduce, and this is the notion of spiritual science and how to achieve it and how to understand these texts in a very profound way of understanding, that is direct spiritual perception.
Well, in a new way.
What do you think? You go have a department of the soul anytime soon?
Yeah, I think it's very important to understand ourselves. Especially since reality and our perception of reality could be at odds.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and one does have to know that.
So just
From my own point of view, I really think that in the Enlightenment we made a big mistake. Just trashed everything. All the traditional knowledge of the human race was just like, let's start over again from scratch. And now people are trying to start to go back. Wait, what did these people know? You know, you got Harvard biologists going down the Amazon jungle trying to find out what the local shaman knows about drugs and things like that. There was actually quite a body of knowledge at one time, and modes of awareness that everybody just jumped and started from scratch. I think people are starting to see the consequences of that excess. And in a way, I think what we've seen is these kind of... when there was the Enlightenment, when the Enlightenment took place, European Enlightenment, there was almost immediately what Isaiah Berlin called the Counter-Enlightenment. And this Counter-Enlightenment gradually flourished and developed into European Romanticism, where you say we murder to dissect, and when the Enlightenment wants to see the whole world as rational, fully intelligible, fully understandable and controlling by human beings. I mean, this is basically becomes the scientific project. Romanticism looked or organicity, wholeness, depth experiences, and so on. And I think the counterculture of the 60s was also you can trace it back to Romanticism. This Romanticism had its bad things too, but irrationality, I think it produced Nazism, little things too, but anyway, still the attempt is there to somehow recover something that we missed and something that was lost. And what to me is very attractive about Srila Prabhupada is that he does represent somehow or other a very archaic tradition that's been passed down through the years. I think as a living, as far as I'm concerned, he really has done what he claims to have done, present Bhagavad Gita as it is. And in some ways it's an antidote to the one-sidedness of our present global culture. Yeah, how it'll all work out, I don't know. We'll have to see. But I think it's really necessary. We're not the only tradition that's trying to do this kind of thing either, of course. But it should be, I would like to see it taken seriously on its own terms. You know, when people in the academic study of religion, they have this sort of way of distancing themselves from the text. There's in the Svetashvatara Upanishad. So here's a text, some words. And certainly, academic scholars of religion, they study these texts. They know Sanskrit, and they try to understand them. They have their own framework in which they try to understand these things. But the interesting thing about the Svetashvatara Upanishad, the very last text, tells you how to understand it. It says, Yasya Devi Para Bhaktir Yata Devi Tatai Gurau Tasyaite Katita Hyarata Prakashante Mahatmana. The import of these discussions, the meaning, will prakashante, means shine forth. For that person, that great soul, who has para bhakti, pure devotion, to root Devi, to the Lord, and in the same way to Guru, to the teacher, the spiritual master. So if that is there, then you will understand what these texts are saying. So there's like directions right there, what you do. And so what my impulse was, well, if that's what it says to do, that's what I'll do. But the other people, they read the text and they try to understand it, but they don't do that. They keep it like sort of distance like this. The same with the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, somehow or other, here is Krishna speaking to Arjuna. Arjuna is a representative human being. He's speaking to me too. I came to understand it in that way. But you can take this completely clinical kind of approach where you're not involved. You're not affected by it. You just look at it like some alien thing. Never quite able to understand that anymore. But that's the method. But there's a way to take it on its own terms. And why not? Why shouldn't we? Anything else you want to ask or talk about, or is there? Anything you ever want to know about Hare Krishna? I'm always afraid to ask. Yeah.
A question about the super soul, or a couple of questions that you mentioned. Is the super soul distinct for each individual, or is it one kind of?
Yeah, there's one super soul. The idea that the soul is called Atma. And then there's the Paramatma. So the idea is that the super soul is within the heart of the soul, and in the heart of every living being. In a way, the super soul is also the soul of the universe. The whole universe is one vast, active, living intelligence that is running it as the super soul, and that intelligence is in our heart, and so this is sound. The one super soul appears distributed, because when it comes to transcendence, you don't have the same kind of spatial problems as you have on our level. But it's something like television. there's a studio somewhere and there's a guy that appears in thousands of millions of living rooms, except the one that appears in the television screen is identical with the one in the, and it's not a reproduction, it's the original. So that's the idea of the super soul. So there's one super soul. And the idea also is that the relationship between our individual intelligence and the super intelligence is there, and what happens when we become spiritually enlivened is that we can begin to have contact with the super soul and receive instructions and directions directly. This should be the experience of Bhagavad Gita, that what you read in the Bhagavad Gita turns out to be what you knew already but didn't know you knew. That what the super soul was saying in your heart and what is on the page is actually the same. And the active relationship between the soul and super soul will begin.
What is the relationship between the super soul and Krishna?
According to the teachings, when you're dealing, what you're dealing with ultimately is the ultimate source of all energies. Prabhupada uses the word the absolute truth. Or when we have the phrase supreme personality of Godhead. Godhead denotes this absolute truth, and that means that from which everything comes. The basis of this spiritual research of the Vedic sages is that everything that we see, all manifestations, ultimately are sustained by something, and that something that sustains them is the self-sustaining eternal being. And this is what we mean by the absolute truth. We are all dependent, but there's one unique being who is independent. So that this is the target of this research of knowledge, is to understand this absolute truth. The Vedanta Sutra begins atato brahma jignasa. Now one should inquire into Brahma, this absolute truth. And the next sutra defines it. Janmadasyataha, that from which everything comes, by which everything is maintained, and to which everything is reabsorbed. Periodic intervals, it goes out and in. So this absolute truth, there's a text in the Bhagavatam says that this one absolute truth is non-dual. Nevertheless, researchers who know this truth know it in three different ways. One is as the all-pervasive, homogeneous, undifferentiated ocean of spiritual light, Brahman, the Brahma Jyoti. And when one encounters this, one feels absorbed into it with a loss of personal identity. This is one aspect. This impersonal Brahma Jyoti, and this has been testified to all over in religious traditions everywhere, this experience. Then there's another, which is called the super soul, Parameshwara. Parameshwara is the experience of the intelligence that runs the universe and the spiritual intelligence in everyone's heart is especially realized by the practice of yoga. Patanjali's Yoga Sutra aims at ultimately connecting with the super soul. And the super soul is this aspect of the divine, which is guiding and directing the material world. The third realization is called Bhagavan. And this is, Bhagavan is the, word that Prabhupada translates as Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Godhead means Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, the Absolute Truth. But the Absolute Truth also, as it is impersonal, is also persons, an individual, personal. Just like we are persons. Where do we come from? We come from the Absolute Truth, so therefore there also must be personality in some way, also in transcendence. And so this is called Bhagavan. Now, according to the Vedas, the Bhagavan from the Absolute Truth come different kinds of energies. One kind of energy is the material energy, which we see here. Another energy is called is the spiritual energy, or interior. This is called the external energy, and there's the other, the internal energy, the spiritual energy, which is another nature. And that's what people call the kingdom of God. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna refers to it as my abode. He said this material world sometimes is existing and sometimes not existing, but that always stays. So when the Lord is dealing with his own internal energies, this is really the idea of Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One aspect of him is Paramatma, because there is the same Lord. There's only one God, but here is that same one Lord simply dealing with the material energy. And the souls that are in it. So sometimes this is explained in terms of the idea of expansion, that the one personality of Godhead expands himself into multiple forms, although they remain one. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says this one line, Eka Amshena Distojagat, with a little piece of myself, I maintain this entire universe. This is the super soul. So all three are aspects of the Absolute Truth. And ultimately, one encounters all of them. So it's the same person, but just different aspects or different relationships become. Just like I may sustain a number of roles, or social roles. Let's say here's a guy. Let's say he's a judge, sits on the bench in the court, right? So in that context, he wears his robes, and people address him in a certain way, Your Honor, and so on. He acts differently. That's one. Then he goes somewhere else. Maybe the same lawyer that was being very deferential goes out and plays tennis with them. They wear different kind of clothes, they act differently, talk differently, different relationship. Then he takes a shower, puts on a coat and tie, goes to the university, teaches some law students in the law school. Another set of roles, another set of... So, see, we have various social roles, and we look differently, we act differently, we have different vocabularies and so on. So this is what the idea that there's one God, one personality of Godhead, but because has so many different relationships with different kinds of devotees, it appears in the different ways. And a lot more, we can only sustain so many roles, and we lose our integrity. We can't hold it together. But with God, he could be very, very diverse and very unified at the same time. Okay, is that clear? About Parma? Super soul. Yeah. And so much of the Bhagavad Gita is talking about the super soul and how to realize super soul, how to get guidance in this way.
I know a lot of people who believe in something called the higher self, I guess. So if you're familiar with that term?
Yeah, I've heard it. I don't know what they mean by the higher self. If they mean myself, purified of all kinds of garbage, or maybe my better self.
It seems to have a spiritual.
Yeah, sure. Well, the idea is that at least the way it's taught in the Bhagavad Gita, is that I am self. I am a spiritual being. The Atma. By the way, this means that I'm mistaken about who I am, because if I am Atma, if I am spiritual, it means I'm not the body. This is a saying in Sanskrit, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, I am spiritual. The corollary is I'm not matter, and the further corollary is I'm not the body. So the self, Atma means self, but the self is neither the body or, by the way, the mind. In Western thinking, the idea of the soul and the idea of the mind are conflated together. But in Vedic thought, the soul is, presence of soul is known by consciousness. Consciousness is the symptom of the presence of soul. You cannot say we cannot experience the soul, because the soul is the condition of our having any experience whatsoever. Seems like here's this little machine, right? It's recording. I guess it's hearing what's going on here in a way. But it's just a piece of matter taking up space. See, there's nobody at home. But here my body's a piece of matter taking up space. And little machines are going on, ears are hearing and so on like that. But I'm conscious of what my ears are hearing. So the consciousness means the capacity to have experiences, to undergo experience. This means I have significance for myself. Whereas this object only has significance for others. So I'm not just an object, I'm a subject. I undergo experiences. I have significance for myself. This, according to Vedic, this consciousness does not arise out of material combinations, but is a separate energy and comes together with the material energy. This is the self. But the self is part and parcel of the Supreme, the Super Self. So we're intimately, he is, I am the soul, then there's the soul of all souls. And this is the super soul. We're identical in quality. The super soul is spirit or Brahman, and I am Brahman also. But I'm tiny, and the super soul is great. So I'm not one with the super soul in every respect. And as I say, I'm not God. But there's an intimate relationship, and when the garbage is cleared out, that relationship becomes, self-evident. Ultimately, the existence of the super soul is self-evident. Just a fact of experience. I can no more doubt the existence of super soul than I can doubt my own existence. In this way, Descartes was right. The ontological argument is accurate. You can't doubt the existence of God. If you do, you don't know what you're talking about. So anyway, that's the idea. So when people say the higher self, I don't know what they mean, whether they've confused them or not. Yeah.
With the Krishna conscious position on cloning and stem cell research.
On what?
Cloning and stem cell research. What the Krishna conscious perspective is on those two political issues. Sorry. I really want to know.
You really want to know, huh? Yeah, I thought a little bit. According to actual principles of Krishna consciousness, every time you have a fertilized egg, you have a human being. That's a fact. And it seems yeah, we should never get into this reproductive technology. This is the trouble in modern life. And what people, why do you need reproductive technology for billions of years? Not billions of years, but yes, millions of years. Human beings have managed to reproduce just fine. Why is it such a problem now? We can't even do the basic things anymore. You know, you need to have all this stuff like that. I'd prefer they get stem cells from without. Killing other human beings. Sure. Cloning, that's a little different, I think. It's sort of a Frankenstein sort of a technique. People don't know what they're doing, but in cloning, it's just a sort of artificial form of reproduction. Somehow you make your body some place a spirit soul can enter into somehow or other, as far as I understand that. Right? But using embryonic cells better not to do it.
If it was from miscarriages or something, not abortion.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so, but and I suppose you say, well, abortions are going to happen anyway, you might as well do something, but the whole thing is a little distasteful. It's funny with us, because on this matter, you know, we sound like the Christian right, you know? but on the other, it's an interesting experience, just to show you where the Krishna consciousness movement is at in the American political spectrum. I've known devotees who have become active in the animal rights movement, because from the Krishna perspective, they're also souls, and actually they have, according to the Vedas, they have civil rights. Animals are citizens and they have some kind of civil rights, and they're to be protected, not killed unnecessarily, and so on. So devotees have gotten active sometimes in the animal rights movement, and I've known other devotees who become active in the anti-abortion movement. And from each side, they've reported me a difficulty that the people who are in the anti-abortion try to tell them that, you know, animal slaughter is the same thing. The people just flip out, because for us, from our perspective, they're the same, and the same thing. People who are in the animal rights movement, they want to say to them, abortion is the same, because the people in the animal rights movement are usually on the left side of the spectrum, you know, and they're for continuing with abortions, and people of the anti-abortion on the right side of the spectrum, they certainly like their beef. We belong to sort of both of them and neither of them at the same time. This is just sort of a measure of the place. So when one wants to vote as a Hare Krishna, it's very difficult. There's really not a good candidate for us. Huh?
Huh? Vegan. Kuchinich was vegan.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah. I didn't win any. No American won't trust anybody who doesn't eat meat. I remember when Jimmy Carter was the president, they had decided to have a vegetarian day in the White House. There was such an uproar from the meat industry that they had to cancel it.
He also liked Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is. In Los Angeles, they said that some devotees saw on a news show, he was arriving in India, and he held up, you know, Bhagavad Gita as it is, and he said, you know, I've been reading this, and this is really quite a book, right? You know, this is very fascinating, I really like it, and so he was just in an airport lounge, mm-hmm. and then the boys, I tried to get a copy of that video tape, and then the news put that in the cloud. Go out because
too many people
might
become interested in
something else other than
the
eyeballs.
Anything else
you
might want to talk about? Yeah.
What personality of God and consciousness would be the type who plays tennis with you? Or is the more personal side? When you're talking about different styles.
Yeah, that's Bhagavan. Here's particularly the idea of Krishna. The particular idea of Krishna, when you say Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there's really two aspects of Bhagavan. One is called Narayan, and this is the Lord in majesty. You know, everybody. I sometimes like to listen to Bach cantatas, you know, and then you get the Lord of Majesty, greatness, power, you know. And this is what most people, because God is, in fact, the all-powerful, majestic, greatness. So this is Narayan. When the Lord is manifest as Narayan, he's very majestic, very royal. You're just awed by it. You've just got that presence, you know. And therefore, he's always worshipped in awe and reverence. You feel he's great and you feel small. And therefore you keep your distance. Although there's attraction for God, still you're just aware of, he's just awesome. So it is said that the Lord, because of this, he cannot enjoy intimate relationships because people are just too, he's God, he's just too big. So therefore, the same Lord as Krishna causes the devotees to forget his position. So that as Krishna, his beauty or his sweetness, his madhurya, overpowers his majesty. And this is the idea of Krishna, is the Lord. You might say Krishna means the private life of God. This is what he does when he's not being majestic. And what is he does? He plays. He plays various kinds of activity for the purpose of developing deeper and ever-increasing ecstatic relationships, emotional, spiritual, emotional relationships with his devotees. This is Krishna. And then where this takes place is called Vrindavan. Narayan majestic, that's the urban, the Lord in the urban setting, but in the rural setting, because Vrindavan is like a little village, cowherd boys, hick town, that's where Krishna has these pastimes. So that's where, I don't know about tennis, but whatever the prototype of tennis is, it's going on there. If there's sports here, that means there's sports there. So all those things are going on, and so that's the idea of Krishna. And Krishna is considered to be a kind of higher manifestation than Narayan. Higher in the sense that the relationships are more intense and more intimate. Or just like, say you get invited to some function in England, and you go to some official function and you meet the Queen of England, right? So you've probably been, if you're an American, you've been taught how you bow or curtsy and say Your Majesty and so on like that. And it's a very formal occasion, and this is the Queen, right? So you've met the Queen, and if you've met the Queen at this occasion, to some extent, you've arrived. But suppose Suppose you become somehow or other a personal friends with the royal family. And then, you know, you go into the Buckingham Palace on a Sunday morning, the Queen's in her house coat, and her slippers with her dogs and everything, and you sit around the breakfast table and you call her Bess, I guess that's what they call her, or something like that. It's not formal, it's not opulent, but see, and everybody wants to know what goes on behind the walls of Buckingham Palace, right? The private life of the rich and famous. And so when you're admitted to the private life, then you've really arrived. So this is the sense in which the relationship with Krishna is considered higher than the relationship with Narayan or Vishnu. But anyway, those people whose taste is for the majesty, that's fine. I mean, that's their proclivity, and for them, that's their satisfaction. That's fine. It's not that ultimately, in one ultimate sense, one's better than another. But still, from another point of view, this revelation of Krishna, the private life of God, is quite confidential, not revealed very often. This is where you just have fun. We could stop now. I guess we're going to have Aarti in about 10 minutes. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.